Hi, and welcome to the Becoming Trauma-Informed podcast, where we help you understand how your past painful experiences are affecting your current reality and how you can shift those so you can create your desired future. I'm Dr. Lee, and both myself and our team at the Institute for Trauma and Psychological Safety are excited to support you on your journey. We talk about all the things on this podcast. No topic gets left uncovered. So, extending a content warning to you before we get started. If you notice yourself getting activated while listening, invitation to take care of yourself and to pause, skip ahead a bit, or just check out another episode. Let's dive in. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode. I'm joined by the incredible, amazing, lovely, glorious Tamara Williams Van Horn. Tamara, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Saying your name out loud, because that's a place for me that I have trauma around my name. And so I always try to say people's names right and don't always succeed. And I still remember the first time you were like, you say it, like, think of the song Annie, like Tamara. And I'm like, every time I say your name now, I just sing that and I know how to say it. And so
that's awesome. I mean, you know, to be associated with a plucky song, like, why not?
Right. It really works. So now all of our listeners will always say your name right, because they'll have that song in their head too. You're welcome. Y'all, you know, I usually talk about how I know our guests, and I was actually thinking about it before we started. I forgot that Tamar, not Tamara, our friend Tamar introduced us, and Tamar is one of my favorite humans ever. And she and I met through another friend way back when, 10, 12 years ago, when we were both doing network marketing and ended up on the same team. And I think she just messaged you, right? And was like, hey, you should check this out.
To the group, and was like, I think that you would be into this. And
yeah,
been really into it.
Yeah. And like, cute, like, fast forward a few years of just like, I mean, it was a total stepbrothers moment for me of like, did we just become best friends? Because I have just been in love with you since the moment I met you. And I'm really excited for you to tell everyone who you be, because y'all, Tamara, I don't know if you've met me, but I like to talk. And Tamara is one of the humans in my life that, like, when she's talking, I don't want to talk. I just want to listen. That's rare for me. So I'm so excited for you to tell everyone who you be, and also to just have this conversation with you, because I'm excited to expose our guests to the same experience I have of like, oh, just keep talking. Like, I'm just going to like curl up and sit crisscross applesauce by the fire as Auntie Corn Tamara like says all the things. So
please
just, who are you? Like, what's important to you? Who, you know, why are you here? What do you do?
Yeah, it's so interesting that you talked about like the importance of saying names correctly. I have a lot of ambivalence around name and labels, which we're going to get into. So I am legally Tamara Renee Williams Van Horn of the Cincinnati Williamses and the Wyoming Sharonville Van Horns. Strangely
so weird.
Enough.
It's so weird. We're from the same little like teeny tiny town in
Absolutely.
Ohio.
So my spouse's family is actually from Sharonville, and my husband grew up a military brat and did not have a close connection with that side of the family. So when we met, it was just, I mean, literally, it's just how the universe is tiny and small. And who I be is the Auntie Corn. I am full in my auntie era. I know there's been some conversation in the on Rihanna's internet about, you know, Black women of a certain age really having, you know, complicated thoughts around auntie. I'm a historian, among other things. So I love the stories that inform how we name ourselves, how we talk to each other, how we treat each other, how we collaborate and group together. So it should be no surprise that my undergraduate degree is in African and African American studies, and my master's degree is in sociology. So I spend a lot of my time supporting young people. I work at a university, and I work mainly with the students who have been traditionally marginalized or parts of traditionally marginalized populations. So that's women in FIM, that's LGBTQIA plus students, that is students of color, and then also students of culture. So our ethnic and religious minorities in the country, so non-Christian folks. We really do a lot of programming. I'm on a team of 10. We are professional identitarians, which not a lot of people do. I get paid to show up as a Black non-binary human. And I use that platform to sharpen my thought leadership, to pass along lessons that I've been given and that I've learned, and to really stand for things like public education that our elders fought and died for. Because again, I have this degree in African and African American studies, and I'm also 30 something year member of Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority Incorporated. So Greater Service, Greater Progress. We were founded by seven teachers, at Butler University in response to Klan violence in the 1920s. So I am the Auntie Corn, and I profess leadership strategies, and I'm unique in that I love being an auntie. I have a very nurturing quality that I want to bring to the world, but I also dabble in magic and I dabble in possibilities. And I want for all young people to have a better world, the best world that the biggest brains on this planet can make for them, because they deserve it.
See what I'm saying, y'all?
There's like so many different directions that I could take this. And you and I had a conversation a couple of days ago that spurred me to really think about, like, oh my gosh, we need to do a podcast episode about this. And then my in-laws came into town, and my father-in-law is also a historian. Really, gosh, the man knows everything about the Wild Wild West and, like, you know, that era of American history and also just like military history. And we were talking about the new show, Bass Reeves. He was kind of educating me on, like, you know, the Lone Ranger, that whole character is based on actually a Black man. And he was talking about how he couldn't read and write. And he's like, it's so fascinating to me. He's like, I know it was a different time, but I just can't imagine looking at an entire group of people and being perfectly comfortable, like, subjugating them. And he's like, and the thing that makes the least amount of sense to me is, like, that, you know, Bass Reeves didn't know how to read or write. And he used that to his advantage, because that was how he captured a lot of the outlaws that he brought in. I think he brought in over 3,000. And he's like, why would they teach them how to shoot guns, but not teach them how to read or write? And it was fascinating for me, because my father-in-law is a very smart man. And I was like, well, think about it. Like, education is the most dangerous weapon you can give somebody.
Yeah.
And I just, that story just popped in my head as you were talking, because you're still in the academic space. I was in the academic space for a really long time, both as a participant and as a mentor. And it's one of those things that it strikes me that, you know, especially talking about the sorority that you were part of, like, we're forming this in response to violence, and it's based on education.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, if you're listening to this, listeners, anywhere near when it's released, Angelina Jolie's daughter, Zahara, who is adopted, Ethiopian in descent, just pledged Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority at Spelman. And it's been all over the news, and it's been really, really interesting. Like we talked on Friday, I'm addicted to the comments. So I have to read the social response to some of these news articles, and the amount of misinformation and disinformation that is out there about the history of education and the availability of education in this country, and kind of the vitriol to folks being willing to do almost anything to secure the chance of education, not even for the generation that's working on it, but for future generations, has just been fascinating to watch. And there's been a lot of grief around that, that luckily I've been working to build a tool chest and a toy box to process, because being in the African-American history space is tough.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah. And it's not, and you know, the work that you're doing right now, it's not your first rodeo, right? Like, I mean, you've been in that space. I know you're in that space in Cincinnati. And the new venture that we were talking about that you're embarking upon, the synchronicities are kind of clicking in my head right now, because you've always focused in on, we refer to them as the babies, right? Like, you've always looked at how do we help the generations that are like coming into adulthood really deal with the, what's the word, the disillusionment and the confrontation and the stark contrast, I think, a lot of times, of what you thought that was right. going to look like and what it actually looks like. And in particular for those babies, those new grown ones that are entering into that space where their identities are not understood or right. validated or honored in the spaces that they're coming into.
Absolutely.
So like, I guess I'm curious, you know, what, well, I know a little bit of these answers, but, and also I want the listeners to hear, I'm like, why is it important to you?
Yeah, because Auntie Corn is a play on unicorn. I am a unicorn. First of all, I live in the Wild West now. I live in Colorado. You do. So Bass Reeves and Stagecoach Mary have been real new ways to communicate with the history and looking at a different perspective on the experience of African descendant folks on Turtle Island and the Buffalo Soldiers, who my dad was fascinated with. You know, I grew up with stories just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. I went to public schools just like everybody else. I had a very ordinary upbringing, and also I was not supposed to be here. I grew up in the projects. My mother is a single parent. She raised three of us on her own. Not a lot of money, of course. We were on public assistance, not only with housing, but we received food assistance. I was on reduced lunch. And yet, by the time I was 12, I was comfortable at a symphony, at a ballet. I was exposed to an amazing library system and was encouraged to read. I got my library card as soon as I could sign my name, and I practiced from 5 to 6 to be able to sign my name, even though that wasn't on the curriculum yet. I started reading at 2. So, you know, as a sociologist, we talk about demography isn't destiny, but it's darn sure deterministic. And the social determinants of health is where I focused my attention, because I grew up in front of a dump. Literally, there was a chain link fence separating the end of the housing project with one of the major landfills in Cincinnati, because that's where cheap land was. 30 years later, I'm now able to put that story together. And things like environmental racism and where you build public housing, because that's where you can get cheap land for underfunded government projects. And really the barriers to success that exist for people who are embroiled in poverty and using public assistance that says you can't make more than this much money or we'll take away your benefits.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
In my day, it was you can't have a male in the home. So I grew up knowing that there was no incentive for my mother and father to make it work, because financially it was better off for them both to live in separate households. So, you know, my own personal story is very important to me because I, quote unquote, got out. My mom worked really hard and was able to win us a house in one of the dollar lotteries. I don't know if these still exist, but they'll take condemned houses and that have been taken over by the county, and they'll raffle them off for a dollar plus guarantee that you can have it renovated to a certain standard. So when I was 9 years old, we left the projects and we moved to a very lower middle class working class, let's be real, neighborhood, and also it was ours. And I got to pick the color of my walls, and I got to have my room, and we didn't have to have social workers coming over to check on us and make sure that we were doing all the things in compliance. And there were a lot of kiddos that I left behind. I was never sent to a neighborhood school. I was always bused to schools, to magnet programs. I grew up in the first public Montessori school in the country. So I'm super weird in that I have a completely different pedagogical foundation than so many Black children in Cincinnati proper, regardless of their economic status. And that carried on. Walnut Hills, which is still one of the top 100 high schools in the country. It's a classical college preparatory school. I'm a legacy to Walnut Hills. I have my mother, my uncle, so education was very much pushed in our family. And I responded to it very well. I have two younger brothers who responded very, very differently. So it's important to me to not only account for and leverage the privileges that I've been given, but also to understand that stimulus and response is not guaranteed, and to make as much spaciousness for as many different experiences to thrive within the systems of education, because, like you said, it's critical to our future as a planet that we scrape as much talent and grow as much talent from all the places and all the experiences. And so, yeah, I spend a lot of time kind of holding space open for students who don't think they can come through to come through, and to really let them have the experiences in the educational system that they have, and try to use my networks and my knowledge to place them where they best belong, including sometimes a different educational environment than where I work and what we sit in. And even, when they're looking at where they want to go after high school, like really helping them customize that journey to fit their needs and to account for their needs. Many of the students that I work with are like me, and they were never told they were allowed to have needs. When you grow up like me, you know that you have to get out. You know you have to get up, and you know you have to give back. And those are put upon us. To whom much is given, much is required. Is something that I heard from lots of different places. And I took that very, very seriously. And I still do take it seriously. And luckily, with the work that I've been doing in the trauma-informed space, I'm allowing that to soften and come from a place of joy and generation, and not from a place of obligation and fear.
One of the reasons I love talking to you is because when you're sharing your experience, it clicks things in around mine that like were a little wobbly or nebulous. And I'm like, oh, yeah. And you and I were having this conversation around Black excellence. And I am so incredibly grateful for the fact that my grandparents on both sides, white and Black, really understood that the way that they were going to help their kids, my parents and my uncles, was through education, was through ensuring that they got good educations. And, you talk about your experience of like getting out and then paying it forward. My experience was less getting out. Like the getting out was two generations ago. My grandfather, let me get this right. My great, great uncle, he was the principal of an all Black school that ended up getting integrated. And so he really protected my grandfather, ensured he was involved in basketball. And, there's some ways for him to get out. So it's so that get out generation was two generations ago. And I believe that my sister and I were really the last, like, carry it forward, take it as far as you can, keep progressing, keep bringing the legacy to fruition. And one of my absolute favorite things is looking at my children and going, I don't know if all three of them will go to college. And I love that for them, you know? Well, first of all, we've told them, you know, like, look, three of the four of us have doctorates, and your dad could totally have a doctorate, right? Like if it made any sense for him to get one, he'd get one. And what are you going to do? Get two? There's no way for you to carry this forward any further other than what you just said around shifting your education and what you decide to deepen into and learn more about and bring to the world, shifting to a place of joy and generation instead of obligation.
Yep.
Because I don't fault my parents for this one bit, but there was no conversation around if I was going to college or not. It was, which college are you going to and how much of a scholarship are you going to get?
Absolutely. Same. And, you know, that juxtaposed with the environment, like, you are special. You can do things that other people can't. And so you are required to embody that fully. But it was a vision that was cast forward for me.
Yeah.
I started looking at colleges at 13 years old when I took the SAT because there was a talent search program. And what I understood at the core of my being was that I had to put myself in positions where people could see the academic talent, specifically academic talent. I have other talents. Those were not nurtured. And to position myself to get into the best school, the school with the best reputation possible. I applied to 10 colleges. I got accepted to 10 colleges. Mm. And I wound up accepting admission to Cornell University because at the time I was obsessed with hospitality management. Again, through the trauma work, I'm like, oh, first responders, hospitality, these nursing, these are places where people with a lot of trauma show up. So now it makes a lot of sense. And it was a flame out year. It was my first academic failure. It rocked my identity. I had no idea who I was without academic accomplishments. I had no idea. I had never had to be resilient in that way. And I wasn't. There was no like, okay, we're going to dig in the office hours and set up study groups. No, it was like, I am a failure. I am disappointing the fought and died. Mm-hmm. I am a waste of the investments that were given, and I'm the one who got out. And so look at what I'm doing with my chance. That sits with me every time I sit across from a transfer advisor or a student now. I'm like, I remember feeling like that. And I remember all of the resources that it took to get me back to a more stabilized orientation of my internal worth. And so I start there with students, and I start there with transfer folks because I am at a flagship university. Everybody thinks their student needs to be here or else what's the point? And I really tell people, listen, this is a great place for a lot of humans. And this is a place that will grind some other humans into the dirt. And let's do some real intentional thought processes and nervous system processes and resource evaluation. Like, let's survey and see if this is the right solution for your educational goals. And sometimes they're not. And I've had a few students who have either transferred or chosen to go to a different place. And I keep my door open. I say, I want to know what happens regardless of where you go. And I've gotten a couple of thank yous, like from people who made a different choice. And they're so much happier. They're so much more regulated. Some of the things that are really hard to do here weren't as hard in other places. And they're like, and that was the same thing when I was teaching too. Like, my students generally hated me after the 16 weeks, but give it a semester. And then they came back and they would say, you know what? I thought you were just doing this out of dysregulation. I'm like, yeah, well, I was. And also, but they're like, I did this other thing and it was so much easier. I did this other thing and it made so much sense. And that was actually how I was trained. And so you know, a little bit of the Midwest butt kicking that I got actually turns out to be just what some humans need. And I supplement that with a little bit of the Wild Westness of there is no right answer.
Yeah.
We get to pioneer our own course. And now you are a legal adult. Let's do it. Like, we get to hold up everything that you've been taught and take a look at it. And you're going to keep some of it, and you're going to negotiate some of it, and you're going to bury some of it or burn it with fire. And I will be here to support you at every step of the way.
You just said a whole word right at that very end. I was like, oh, okay. I'm listening to her. And I'm like, just taking them. I'm like, oh, I know where I want to take this. And then I'm at the last part, I was like, nope, going somewhere different. Because, you know, we do a lot of that same work at the Institute of like, and I know you know this, you've been through, you've been in a lot of our spaces for a hot minute now. And that, like, we're going to hold this up and look at it and go, yeah, I know you thought this is where you were supposed to be, and it still might be where you're supposed to be. And also, are we allowed to question that thought?
Yeah.
Like, are we allowed to hold up this identity that you've created for yourself, or that other people have kind of, you know, strong-armed you into creating for yourself, for some of us from a very young age? And like, can we hold it up? Can we look at it? Can we examine it from all sides? Can we look at how harmful it is? Can we look at how beneficial it is? And can we take the emotion out of it for a minute? And then also, can we go way deeper into the emotion of what it means to hold this identity than probably anyone's ever held space for you to do so?
Yeah.
I know you do that because we've had conversations about the students who come right through your door and sit on the couch and like in existential despair, of like, what am I doing with my life? And that's not, you know, that's 18, 19, 20.
Yeah. And it, first of all, I want to thank your spaces because before it was an instinct and yeah. Not a particularly well-developed instinct. It was a way to make sense of the educational trauma that I experienced because I came out here to be a doctorate. Mm-hmm. I came out here pursuing a doctorate in sociology, and I left at the critical stage in the process called all but dissertation. And again, just like that Cornell academic failure, I had all of that came right back. Like, who are you? Your mom didn't work so hard to get you out of the projects for you to go on ahead and mess this chance up. And that was what I lived with for a couple years.
Yeah.
And as I began to put postdoctoral life together in a different way, I knew what I wanted to take forward, what I wanted to keep, and what I wanted to burn with fire. And so going into getting more trauma-informed, because I had done a ton of research in intergenerational trauma as yeah. part of my degree, and I had actually worked in hospital-based trauma before that. I was part of an injury prevention team that specifically worked with Black community churches to do a lot of education around car seats and helmets specifically, but also just in general thinking about intergenerational trauma from a physical safety perspective and yeah. the ways in which our neighborhoods and streets might not be set up with the same safety mechanisms as other neighborhoods that maybe had a different racial or ethnic mix or different yeah. socioeconomic status. So I've been in trauma spaces, and what I really wanted to do is meld this big brain that's hypervigilant and overthinks and to really make that my superpower. And as I bring my nervous system more into alignment and attunement, the capacity to attune, to really be able to give that to students way earlier than my mid-40s, which was when I found it. And yeah. in doing that, they can make their own decisions. I don't need to put my experience on them. I don't need to save them from their disapproving families or any of that. I can present them with opportunities to experience a different way and space and language and vocabulary to figure it out and feel it out. And then they put together their own solution packages, and I just kind of support them and try and hold them accountable to what they've built for themselves. So it's not accountability like, oh, a late library fine or anything. It's more accountability like, listen, you sat on my couch and told me that you really wanted to live your life in your truth. And I want to support you in doing that. So how can we regulate you to have hard conversations to tell people who you are rather than exist in like a passive aggressive, go along to get along, don't rock the boat piece because you're in this liminal state. It's hard. It's hard to be a college student, and it doesn't end in college. I do this now with my friends and my colleagues. Anybody who's in transition, anybody who's getting a new piece of data that rocks their world and flips their identity. I have a friend who her last child was born with Down syndrome, and she's a highly accomplished, you know, PhD. And it was a shock. It was a shock. And it took some integration. It took some processing. It took some holding up of, oh, here's all these places where I was holding on to these expectations and these ideas about myself. And now that this new piece of data is inserted, I got to go through the archives and like reframe, and some stuff's got to go. And I love holding that kind of space for people. Mm-hmm. I love watching them move through into self-trust. I like watching them experiment and be like, ooh, mess that one up. How do we repair around that?
Whoops.
And then when they fly, when they notice themselves doing the new thing or being the new being, it is so incredibly gratifying. That to me has become my definition of education. I still love text. I still love vocabulary. And it's no longer the end all be all of the possibilities of education.
Yeah. Ugh. I've seen you do this. You know, I've seen you be that human for people in our collective, you know, that are in that like liminal, you know. And it's one thing for me as the putter together of the group of humans to hold that space, to, you know, the proverbial couch for you to plop down on and go like, what am I doing? And I've seen you do it several times with people where you very, and it's very, when I think of Auntie, and my sister and I were talking about this, that is a respected elder in your community, but not respected because you have to respect them, right? Like you respect them because when they tell you something, it is valuable for you personally. It helps you come more into alignment. And so I've seen you just do that and really embody that role so many times and see so many of our collective members be like, thank you, right? And, you know, what you're talking about here with this education piece, one of my youngest and I, we watch, like, we get hooked on shows. And, you know, some of these shows, people are like, oh my gosh, you're watching this with your 11-year-old? And I'm like, yeah, because we can talk through it. Like, what better way to educate her about some really hard topics? That she said yesterday, she was like, oh yeah, 7 years till I'm an adult. And I was like, oh, holy cow, that's not a lot of time. You know, I know that feels like a really long time to her. I'm like, that's not a lot of time. And so we're watching the show Irrational with, I can't remember his last name, but Jesse, he was the one of the famous detectives on Law and Order and also in Rent. And he's a professor and he has his students do quote unquote experiments. And at first my academic brain had a very hard time with this show because I was like, there's no control. And they're like setting up experiments, but there's no IRB. He's just like sending them out and they're doing the thing. And then I thought about it and I'm like, well, you know, he's actually telling them to go out into the real world and see and translate data, translate topics and concepts and be like, does this actually work where I'm at? with who I am. And I was like, oh, this is rubbing up against me so much because this is what I wasn't allowed to do with my doctoral degree, which is exactly what I was trained to do with my doctoral degree. I wasn't allowed to do this in the academic space. And at the Institute, I get to do this every single day, which is like what's so exciting for me. So whenever people are like, oh, like you're not really using your degree, I'm like, I'm using it more than I ever dreamed possible. And I brought that up because, you know, I think of one of the other identities you mentioned is, you know, the LGBTQIA plus community. And, you know, we've spoken publicly, my husband and I, we have a non-binary kiddo and our eldest and who changed their name. And, you know, talk about a moment where as an adult, there's a lot of deconstruction that gets to happen, especially when you identify as Catholic, when you identify as a person who is tolerant and accepting, and all of these things kind of come up and you're like, wait a second, am I Catholic? Am I tolerant and accepting? Am I these things that I've ascribed to myself and just never really thought about because they never got challenged?
Yeah.
And I think we're also, you know, there's so many reasons why I feel like we met when we did, but one of the beautiful things about you being in our lives is you were one of the first humans I ever met who used she, they pronouns. And I was like, wait, you can do both? Like, what's going on? Right. And you actually were a human that had already kind of cracked that door open to go, okay, maybe these are things you get to look at more. And so then when our kiddo went through it, it's like, all right, you now get to kind of walk your talk. You get to practice what you preach. And the interesting thing is that, you know, my husband and I, we both came out of that whole process. I won't speak for him, but we came out of that process in different ways. And, you know, we both examined our beliefs in different ways and we both love the shit out of our kid and accept them fully and all of that. And, you know, what I believe religiously now is different. What I believe politically now is different. What I believe in a lot of areas is different. And that was really scary.
Yeah. Yeah. Try being in your mid 30s when you come to the realization that the categories that you have lived with, literally, I'm an extremely biddable human. Like, no one ever made room for anything different than your cisgender, heterosexual, and straight. You're a girl, you're a woman, you're definitely, I mean, I grew up when pregnancy was the big bugaboo against Black women. And so I got so much don't get pregnant that nothing else came through, literally nothing else. So as smart as I was, as all these books that I had read, I was like clueless on a huge part of my life, which is my gender and sexual identity. And there had been a lot of friction because I showed up in a lot of spaces as a young person, a little bit too much tomboyish in some interesting ways. It wasn't sports. I'm very protective of my women friends. And I love to spoil my women friends in ways that is extremely threatening to folks in traditional heterosexual relationships that haven't been challenged. And so I had a lot of my friends, boyfriends and husbands be like, if we ever get into a fight, you're going to go move in with tomorrow and leave me, because just the way my energy, and I always thought that there was something wrong with that. And I tried to mold it and shift it and like be a certain kind of distant from the humans that I love so much. And then when the opportunity came up to leave home and come out west to go to graduate school, I was working on a different project, a public health project around sexually transmitted infections. And I found a sexuality institute that was like a summer research institute. And I'm a good student and I knew I hadn't been in the classroom in a while. So I was like, what better than to spend the summer before I start my doctoral studies boning up in San Francisco, which doesn't suck. And it was totally that stereotypical, you go to San Francisco and get turned out. I met people who were like, I am queer in this way, and I am gay in this way, and I am poly, and I am disabled and kinky. And I'm like,
I was like, you messed yourself up, like in the best of ways, right?
In the best way. And
yeah
so I arrive on campus with this license to study and this new awareness of possibilities and so many things, like you said earlier about when I talk, so many things clicked into place. I was able to go back and do a queer reread of my entire history. And I was like, oh, I just didn't have the vocabulary or the social space to make these explorations. And again, that forms a lot of how I show up and what I want to be in the work that I want to put out in the world. And even now, using they, them pronouns came way later, and it came after working with the students, because I was aware of some ways that my preaching was out of alignment with my practice.
Yeah.
Because I am in a very straight passing relationship. I am with a man who has never had a question about his gender identity, and he's white to boot. So we're in an interracial relationship, and we married late, and we have chosen not to have children. So we're doing a very queer project, a very queer project within a very, very traditional set of window panes. And I was aware of that, and it didn't feel right. It felt like passing. If folks know about the tradition of non-white folks who can pass as white, passing as white, it felt like passing. And so that's when I added they to my she pronouns. And I tell everybody, you can't get it wrong. It's not triggering or harmful, and it doesn't activate my dysphoria to say she or to refer to me as a woman. Yeah. And also, because I'm a history buff, it's not as simple as like, my body doesn't feel. No, in this country, the body that I live in and exist in has never been allowed traditional womanhood. And so non-binary makes complete sense to me in the fullness of the truth, not only of my internal, but my external. And how I am framed, and, you know, even what health conditions are in my life course because of epigenetics and histories and lack of access to different resources. So it's been a wild ride. It's been internal family systems work before I knew what that was, bringing out the exiles of all of those behaviors that were queer and neurodivergent, that I was raised in a family where there was no way I could have been diagnosed neurodivergent without causing extreme harm to the family, perhaps even being taken away from my source family. And now just having all these possibilities to explore and not know myself and to be in that experimental phase, I think that helps me do that for other folks, whether they're students or, you know, even my colleagues who were like, I'm too old to explore. And I'm like, yeah, you're never too old to explore.
No.
And with what's going on in this world, we better all start exploring.
Yeah. You know, we were just talking about before we started, and I was like, oh, I almost wish that we'd said this after we started recording. And I'm like, oh, sweet, I get to bring it in, you know? I'm going to be 37 in a few weeks. And like, I grew up in TGIF, like, Family Matters, Boy Meets World, all of those things. And I had just seen a TikTok before I hopped on with Topanga, you know, Danielle Fishel, who has not aged a day. And and I saw her, and it reminded me of a conversation I was having with my sister the other day, where another woman had come up. Oh gosh, I can't remember the name of the band, but I saw her, and in the comments, because I also like to go to the comments, this woman said, do I want to be her or do I want to be with her? Like, I can't really tell. And I was like, oh yeah, that's what's happening inside of my body right now. Like there are instances in which I see women and I'm like, do I want to look like her or do I want to look at her, you know, or do I want to be with her or be her? And that was something that when I was younger was there, And yet it was never something that consciously I even thought to put into words and express externally, because my brain didn't understand the construct, right? It's like before, if you've lived in a space where you've never seen the ocean and you've never even read a book that's described the ocean, and like you have no knowledge of what an ocean is because you live in a landlocked space, and somebody takes you to the ocean and you're like, whoa, right? That was the experience. And then I started, and so when our kiddo, you know, came out, and so we started having these conversations, I was like, wait, did I ever think about if I wanted to get married or not? Like, right. did I ever think about if I wanted to have kids or not? Did I ever ask myself any of those questions? Or was it, no, you're going to grow up and you're going to fall in love and you're going to get married. You're going to have babies. You're going to work until you retire. You're going to get a really great degree. You're going to have a 6-figure job. You're going to have the 2.5 kids and the dog and whatever. And like, that's it. And so at that point, when our kid comes out, you know, we have the dog. We have the 3 kids. We overshot it. We have 3 kids. And yet I have to ask myself those questions. And like, my husband did not, but like, that did not feel good for him to have me ask those questions. And I'm like, but look, you, and he started asking himself some questions too. And I was like, but we have to ask ourselves these questions, as uncomfortable as they are.
Yeah.
Because I want to know that I want to be married. I want to know that I want to have kids. I want to know that like, I am coming to a place where I am choosing that. And I there's a part of me that's like, do not say this out loud. But I have so many mom friends who are like, man, if I had known this was an option,
right,
I wouldn't have had kids. Now, right. I'm not that woman. I would have still chosen to have kids. And there's some grief in that that gets to be felt, of like, I quote unquote made a decision that wasn't a choice. And now I'm finding out it was a choice.
Absolutely. And it's the same on this side. Being queer in the weird way that I am is not super stabilizing for the mm-hmm. human that I'm married with. Like,
right.
Because our traditions, our society has taught us to be very possessive and mm-hmm. to see any questioning as a signal of dissatisfaction. Mm-hmm. And that's not what it is. Mm-hmm. It is a commitment to truth, and it's a commitment to intentionality. And luckily, my spouse is very resilient in some other ways, so it's not a deal breaker, but it takes a particular kind of mental toughness to be with a person who says, I'm pansexual, or I'm bisexual, or I'm questioning my gender, or I have friends whose spouses have come out as trans. All of a sudden, you're like, what does this mean for our relationship? And sometimes it does mean separation. And sometimes it means falling in love with a whole new person
mm-hmm.
within the confines of where you're at. And we don't have conversations that support these experiences. We don't have tools and resources that support these experiences. And we really are just getting into the vocabulary and like developing language to put words to it. So when people who don't have to have a need, a compulsion to answer these questions, go on about the alphabet soup or all the pronouns, or talk about how much of a burden it is to use they as a singular pronoun, it does irritate me a little bit. And then my educator takes over and I'm like, what in your life would benefit from an examination, an inventory? What could be strengthened in your life if you just didn't take it as status quo? And so that's really what I hope to be bringing to the world in terms of business offerings and products and services here next is, I'm part of Generation X and I love it. I've been interested in Generation X as a generation since the early 90s when it kind of came into fruition. So I know it's formed from marketing. It was never intended to be this psychoanalysis of classes of people. It's about how to get you to buy things. And mm-hmm. also it's so interesting, the shared experiences yeah. that are drawn upon. And I say we're X for a reason. And I do think we're meant to be a bridge population to a new set of conversations. And so mm-hmm. I want to reach back. I want to reach forward. I want to reach across difference and really bring some of these gender-based conversations into a space where we can question them safely with psychological safety, wherever we are entering from.
You know, I love how full circle this came, you know, coming back to that. Let me back up. First of all, I'm so freaking excited for this. Y'all don't even know, like the 10% of me that just still gets so stinking turned on thinking about, oh my gosh, how can we market and how can we message and how can we strategize? How can we offer this? Like when you started talking about this, I was like, I am not going to fire hose you because I have so many ideas. And also like, I want it to come out organically and in the most aligned way for you possible. And I'm so excited about this because I just, there's such a need. And this is it coming back to that full circle part, right? I actually think that treating Gen X and boomers, anyone Gen X and older, as humans who don't care or humans who are completely comfortable with the status quo and don't want to change, I think that is one of the most damaging things that we do. I think what we actually do is what, and I'm going to say a bold thing here, is the same thing as not teaching someone how to read or write, but letting them keep their guns.
That's right.
You are saying, I trust you to be violent and nothing else. And like, that's just not the way that I mean, I'm not going to speak for you, but that's definitely not the way that I want to view anyone in humanity is. Yeah. And please.
I was trained to be a Black feminist by a Black feminist, Patricia Hill Collins, who just won $1 million for her thought contributions in Black feminism, which is wild, was my undergrad advisor. And one of the things about Black feminism that is very distinct is that Black feminism does not leave men and boys behind. Mm. It definitely sees uplift of the entire community and the advancement of the evolution of gendered ideas as mm-hmm. all of our work and benefit to everybody. So mm-hmm. yeah, I'm really looking forward to bringing that core part of my being out to say to folks, it's okay to have big feelings. It's okay to be confused and scared and feel like your foundation's being rocked, because a little bit it is. And mm-hmm. it's also okay to use that as fuel to get curious
yeah.
and to connect in a new right. way, to connect in a different way, so that we can create these new possibilities of, you know, some of my students come to me and tell me stories about their grandparents being the most forward with accepting their mm-hmm. different gender projects or even their different like life projects. I am working with a lot of women who don't want to have children. Mm-hmm. They are heterosexual women and they just don't want to choose motherhood. And in the cultures of many of the students that I work with, that is not okay. There is yeah. like that's seen as something wrong. So it's fine to have traditions and big feelings and questions and confusion. And what if you could get supported through that? And you don't have to fix anything, including yourself. You may get to learn some new skills. You may get to approach life's curriculum a little bit differently. You may be able to access some pieces of yourself that you didn't know existed from a curriculum. Like, what if we could structure it less as you getting shocked and surprised at Thanksgiving dinner with here's a step-by-step process that we can walk through and deconstruct these things, including how can I give you pieces of your culture that have been stolen mm. by colonization? The reality is that alternative gender categories and existences exist in almost every culture that's been colonized. It exists in Hawaiian culture. It exists in many, many, many Native nations. It exists in many African traditions.
Uh-huh.
And colonization is what gave us a form of Christianity, as especially as African descended folks in the United States, most of us are some form of Christian by tradition.
Right.
It's what our mamas were and our parents were, and then spirituals and then slavery, right? Like, and also we were given a particular version of the Bible, literally. All of the pieces of the Bible that enslaved folks were given when they taught a few people how to read the Bible, and that is it, removed the Exodus story, because that was the story that talked about slaves rising up and taking back their identity and leaving their masters, their overlords. So that's cool. And that's interesting, and it's legitimate. And I want to be able to be like, that's cool and that's legitimate. And also, if you knew that this is not actually foreign to our experience, what could that open up for you in terms of healing in other parts that have nothing to do with your personal gender or sexuality or your mm-hmm. Christianity? How can you make more room for other folks and make more room for yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. I'm just really grateful for, number one, for your willingness to, your offering to come on here when I was like, I don't know what I'm going to talk about. And you were like, oh, let's talk. I'm like, thank you. Thank you. Number one for that. Number two, for like just your friendship and your thought leadership. And also, like, I think the thing that really just resonates so deeply in me, in our connection and watching the work that you do in the world, is you are, how do I want to say this? The work that you are doing is so beneficently subversive, right? Which is exactly how I describe what we do at the Institute. It is so beneficently subversive. And what I mean by that is, like, traditional subversion is like, I'm going to come in and just like covertly fuck your stuff up. And the beneficent piece is like, I'm going to come in and, like you said, I am going to wreck the way you look at life in the best, most beneficial way for you possible, with your full consent. So we're not going to look at anything that you don't want to look at. And you're allowed to be like, I don't want to look at this, then also let's look at this.
Yeah.
Or I'm really pissed about looking at this, and also let's look at this. Or I'm really pissed that I looked at this and now I can't see things the way that I used to. And so can we have a conversation about that? Like, you know, you said this, and I think this is such a key piece for, you know, what you're going to be doing in the work that you are doing and are moving towards doing more as your business, is people are allowed to have their feelings. Like, you're allowed to be like, this is bullshit to you as they're learning about gender and identity and self-expression and sexuality and all these things. Because the beautiful part of that, it's the same when people come to me around trauma and like saying like, it's bullshit that people are acting this way and showing up very dysregulated. Show up dysregulated to me, babe, right? Because if you're showing up dysregulated to me and we're working through it, if people are showing up dysregulated to you and you're working through it, what that means is you're not showing up dysregulated to the person in your life that it would be so profoundly harmful to That's do so. Right.
And what you don't know in showing up dysregulated is that you're making yourself vulnerable and allowing yourself to experience that unconditional acceptance and undivided attention. And so you're getting the medicine regardless. So you can show up dysregulated, like around all of it. You can show up dysregulated around all of it and still get the medicine. And if you only want to take one vitamin, then that's cool.
Yeah.
Like, I guarantee you what I know for sure is that my medicine is time released. So it'll be a year from now and something will happen in your life and that piece that super activated you will drop in and you'll use it and you'll be like, oh. Mm-hmm. And whether you come back to me or not, you're changed. Like, I'm a theater kid. And that song at the end of Wicked is Change for Good.
Yeah.
You know? And that, if we can be that to each other.
Yeah.
A little bit more.
What a novel form of education.
Absolutely. And you don't need to pay $60,000 to come to a flagship university to do it.
Oh, gosh. Preach. Oh,
like,
gosh.
If you want to, I'm here.
Right. And I'm also, like, as I sit here with, like, we just got my student loans under six figures. Hallelujah. Right. And, like, you know, yeah, you don't need a doctorate. You don't need an AB, like, to be at ABD level. Like, you don't need any of that. This is, I think, one of the things we say at the Institute that I think translates over to your work is, like, this is a remembrance. Like, this is an uncovering, not a recovery, you know?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, sometimes the education you need the most is, like, forgetting some stuff.
Yeah, unlearning.
So, unlearning some stuff.
Sometimes the best learning is unlearning.
Yeah. Well, my dear friend, I'm sure that you've intrigued many a listener with this. Where can people go to learn more about you, learn more about the work that you're doing, how you're being in the world?
All right. So, you know, you've heard about how I show up in the world. So most of my work is actually not publicly accessible yet. So if you're curious and want to have a conversation, it will not be a sales call. It will not be me trying to sell you something. So I can be reached at Tam Van Horn, which is my name, at Gmail. That's also my handle on Facebook and Instagram, Tam Van Horn. And if you want to check out my thought leadership that I put out in the business space, Auntie Corn Leadership Strategies is my page on Facebook. I like making little videos. You'll get to see a lot of Boulder, Colorado. You'll get to see the mountains and the creeks and really pretty buildings. But yeah, I'd love to further the conversation. And I work in a very bespoke manner. So if you are cooking up something and I'm the missing ingredient, let's chat.
I love that. And also, don't worry, y'all. I will be using my Midwestern butt kicking capabilities to get some more of this public, because please. So, you know, there might be a TikTok channel or something coming.
TikTok.
Yeah. So when that comes, however it comes, we'll circle back and make sure we add it to the show notes, and we'll make sure that we have your email and your Facebook in the show notes for everyone as well. Thanks for joining me, friend. I love you so very much.
Same. Thank you.
All right, y'all. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Invitation to head to our show notes to check out the offers and connections we mentioned. Or you can just head straight over to institutefortrauma.com and hop in our email list so that you never miss any of the cool things that we're doing over at the Institute. Invitation to be well and to take care of yourself this week, and we'll see you next time.